Chapter 3, The Technological Environment. In this chapter, we will explain the meaning of technology and its impact on business. We will examine the conditions that need to exist in the external business environment for the creation of an effective innovation environment within the business. We'll critically assess the role of technology and its impact on business performance and economic growth, and we'll end the chapter by exploring some of the ethical dimensions that technological advances are bringing, particularly in relation to the development of ICT, computer technologies, and artificial intelligence, often referred to as AI. Technology is invention and innovation. At its basic level, it's the creation of new ideas or new ways of doing things. Sometimes then it's not just a new idea, but it's how you can do things with that idea. So product innovation, but also then on top of that, how you might improve the way in which you produce products, often referred to then as process innovation. At basis, then, technology is the application of knowledge to production. Why are firms interested in technology? Well, of course, at basis, what technology does is enables productivity to occur, to lower costs. If firms can lower costs, they can establish competitive positions and make more money. But it's not just reducing costs. Technology will enable firms to make quality improvements and also to come up with new ideas and new products which can steal a competitive march on their rivals. Michael Porter argues that technology is something that can impact across the whole of a firm's business operations. And in the chapter, we explore the idea of the value chain, both the horizontal value chain and the vertical value chain. And we see how and where technology, applications of technology can impact to improve the overall productivity and performance of companies. Having looked then at what technology is, we then in the chapter begin to explore in history, how different people have thought about technology. And here we go back to relating it to the political and economic perspectives that we outlined in Chapter 2. The founding father of economics, Adam Smith, was in no doubt the driving force of modern market systems of what we now call today capitalism is technology. If you remember from Chapter 2, what Adam Smith argued was that it was the change in the way in which production was organised away from firms trying to do everything for themselves towards businesses specialising in certain narrow areas, which then meant that they could benefit from the division of labour, specialisation. It then meant that they were able to increase productivity and then through the market reap the benefits of economies of scale. It was this that then began to yield to businesses and entrepreneurs the profits that they could then use to invest in their businesses in the form of machinery and in the form of developing new ever new ways of producing things, and we get a virtuous cycle then of technology, you know, of changes in productivity leading to changes in profits, which then enable technological advances, which then enable changes in productivity, and we get growth in the system. The great critic of capitalism in the 19th century was Karl Marx. Karl Marx was absolutely in agreement with Adam Smith that the driving force of capitalism was this constant need to reinvest, constant need to gear up in terms of technology. But Marx saw this as the Achilles heel of capitalism. If capitalists are constantly locked in a competitive struggle to keep on investing and investing and investing, eventually their profit rates are going to decline, and this will lead to crisis within capitalism. In the 20th century, a follower, someone who read Marx but didn't necessarily agree with Marx's idea that capitalism was doomed to failure, was the economist Schumpeter. Schumpeter indeed saw that technology was a vital part of the growth process, but he did see it as a process of what he referred to as creative destruction. Destructive in the sense that what technology would do is it would lead to the rise and fall of companies. You have a company, have a new idea, they will ride with it 20, 30, 40 years, they'll benefit from that idea. But then somebody else will come along with a new idea which will blow the original company out of the water, and we'll get a new form and a new way of doing things. And eventually Schumpeter's argument was that capitalism would eventually begin to run out of steam. We would achieve what he would refer to as, and many other economists have talked about this concept of, a stationary state. Of course, we saw in the 20th century that particularly in the beginning of the 20th century, capitalism was in a severe state of depression. It was the economist Keynes who then came to the rescue of capitalism by arguing that what was needed to create a successful environment for entrepreneurs was paradoxically an effective and strong state. The state was needed to keep economic activity high, to keep a stable macroeconomic environment, and then in that way, that would create a stable environment in which capitalists would want to make investment decisions. So we've always had this debate then about the role of technology. And is it a good thing for capitalism, a bad thing for capitalism? Is it going to help growth or is it going to hinder growth? Neoclassical economists are absolutely convinced that on balance, technology will always be a good thing. They're technological optimists. They believe that technological developments will always lead to growth, and particularly when we have differences between, for example, rich countries and poor countries, that provided we have open markets or globalization, which we'll consider in chapter 10, and we have ideas which are free to go across borders through technology going across borders, innovation going across borders, that you will always get growth in the system, and importantly, that poorer countries will eventually one day be able to catch up with richer countries. Other economists argue that there's nothing necessary about that. And Jamola and Robinson, for example, argue that if technology is going to be beneficial to countries, you need to have the right regulatory system in place. You need to create the most effective institutions, what they refer to as inclusive institutions, to ensure that the gains from technology are genuinely captured and work to the good of the whole of society, rather than just leading to profits going into the hands of narrow ruling elites. Okay. All too often, what Adjemola and Robinson argue is, particularly in many developing countries, is the institutions which are in place are extractive institutions. So, for example, there's lots of corruption. For example, corporations not paying their taxes. Or, for example, you may have the infiltration of multinational corporations who are using technology to generate profits, but taking those profits out of the country with them, which isn't working in helping the growth of the indigenous countries, the native countries in which the multinational corporations are embedded. So we've got this debate then about the implication, about the impact of technology. In the developed world context, indeed, economists like Gordon and Harjun Chang have looked empirically at growth rates. What Harjun Chang and Gordon argue is that in the earlier periods of industrialization, what Gordon refers to, for example, as IR1 and IR2, the steam revolution and the factory revolution in the 20th century, steam revolution in the 19th century, factory revolution in the 20th century, it was then that productivity really began to take off. However, in what Gordon refers to as IR3, the information technology revolution, we don't seem to see this correlation between investments in technology and rates of economic growth. The economist Solo said, we see technology everywhere, but not in the productivity statistics. And this has given rise recently to what's been referred to as the great innovation debate or the productivity paradox. Despite the huge advances in information technology and now artificial intelligence, there doesn't seem to be, at the moment, in 2018, there doesn't seem to be convincing evidence that these technological developments are feeding into productivity statistics. But for technology pessimists, then, there are real problems that lie ahead, particularly in relation now to the impact of artificial intelligence on labour employment, particularly for people who work in relatively unskilled occupations. The rise of the so-called gig economy, the task rabbit economy, companies like Uber, Airbnb, Deliveroo. It's argued that what technology is now doing is displacing good, well-paid, highly skilled jobs with low-paid, precarious jobs. And that what's effectively happening then is technology will lead to unemployment. And if not unemployment, will heighten the existing inequalities in society. And that's something that we come back to in chapter number 12. So in other words, then, here we are in 2018 looking forward into the impact of technology, and we have a disjunct between technology optimists like, for example, Brynjolfsson and McAfee, who feel that human beings will be ideally placed to win the race against the machine, provided that they are prepared for the challenges that lie ahead, and technology pessimists that argue that without public policy to intervene in markets, for example, reskilling, re-educating, workers particularly those who are going to be displaced from the labour process, and in ensuring effective tax regimes that are able to redistribute the undoubted benefits that technology will bring to some firms in terms of their profits, but redistribute those income to those people who are going to lose out. It remains to be seen then who's going to win that debate.